I'm standing here on England's Jurassic coast, surrounded by remarkable rocks. Some of them look like snakes, some like tongues, and some seem a bit Jewish. You may have heard it said that these exceptional rocks are the remains of dead creatures, which could reshape our entire understanding of our place in the universe. But don't worry, that's not true. They just look like that because of magic from the moon. Join me in this new series as I uncover the secrets of these stones, which were forged literally thousands of years before the release of unrelated Belgian techno anthem, Pump Up the Jam.
Welcome back to the Weird Medieval Guys podcast. I'm Olivia, and this is Aaron, a dinosaur. That's right, this boy is old.
I'm a living fossil.
He's been swimming the seas unchanged for 65 billion years. And now, he's here to podcast with you. Wow, that's so exciting. I scooped him out with my big net.
I'm like if a coelacanth was really into Krabby's alcoholic ginger beer.
And on today's episode of the Weird Medieval Guys podcast, we're going to be talking about fossils. So this was a question we got on our last episode when we did our Q&A session. Someone asked us what medieval people thought of fossils, what their encounters were with fossils, and we just decided that would be a really good thing to devote an entire episode to. And that's what we've done. So in this episode, we're going to be focusing on what types of fossils medieval people and in general pre-modern people might have encountered, what they might have thought about what those things they found looked like and what they were, where they came from, and how they fit into their worldview. And so I think that we're both quite keen, Aaron and I, to get one sort of big refutation out of the way.
Yeah, because I heard on at Real History Facts with a blue tick from X the Everything app that dragons and cyclopses and all the mythological beasts and creatures of the medieval world were based on encounters with dinosaur bones.
Yes, yeah, so there's a lot of this in popular culture. I don't know if you've encountered it on the internet. I certainly have. There are theories floating about that specific mythological creatures might have been inspired by fossils. And this is something that you might hear people talking about in the context of dragons.
Mm-hmm.
Did people find big dinosaur bones, and that's why people thought dragons existed? And there are more specific examples as well. So one scholar, Adrienne Mayer, published a book called The First Fossil Hunters, in which she tries to connect specific mythological creatures from antiquity with specific types of fossils. So, for instance, one that's mentioned is the creature the Cyclops, which she says could have come about from ancient Greek people finding the skulls of extinct pygmy elephants. And another one that she mentions quite a bit, and this one has also been picked up a fair bit by other scholars, is griffins. So she mentions that griffins could have been inspired by fossilized dinosaurs, essentially dinosaurs that were precursors to the Triceratops and similar species, that maybe those big sort of frills that they've got could have been the inspiration for griffins having wings.
And of course their gigantic beaks.
Yes, exactly.
She cites a specific account from a Greek traveler in the classical period called Aristeas, who encountered some Scythian nomads in the Gobi Desert, who told him about a race of lion-sized griffins who guarded great gold deposits in a certain area of Central Asia. Now, there is an area of Central Asia where you have both a lot of gold, and B, a lot of fossils of Protoceratops, so this is the proto-triceratops, that has a giant beak like a griffin. But there are some problems with this argument, despite the fact that it's pretty uncritically repeated in a lot of popular sort of science history literature.
Yeah, so I wanted to give a big thanks to British paleontologist Mark Witten, who has a great blog. He's not only a very accomplished paleontologist and scholar, but he's also a paleo artist, and so he has a lot of interest in looking at the history of how people interpreted fossils and what kinds of creatures they might have constructed from what they found. And he has a great article on his blog, actually a couple, where he goes through these ideas and basically talks about why he thinks they're malarkey. Now, I'm a bit biased because reading these theories, I also think they're malarkey, and so I'm very grateful to have Mark's more scholarly point of view to back me up. But I don't think that his refutations are necessarily controversial, and so let's get into what he thinks about all of this.
Yes, so there's two problems, right, with that argument. So number one, the fossils of Protoceratops that are cited as sort of the inspiration for griffins are literally hundreds of miles away from any recorded ancient gold prospecting sites. So the idea that they would be finding these fossils near the gold and think that, oh, there's those are the bodies of the great griffins that guard the gold is not particularly compelling. And the second issue is that there's no evidence that the griffin myth originated in Central Asia. Griffins are way older than that. You can trace them back to like ancient Egypt as well, so thousands and thousands of years older than this story, and there's no evidence that the myth starts in Central Asia.
And another thing that Mark mentions that I think is often overlooked as well is that the descriptions and depictions that we have of these mythological creatures like griffins and cyclops, they don't actually match the alleged fossils that they're based on that well. Griffins are more like a category of mythical beast than really one specific thing with a fixed, typology or a fixed appearance. There's a huge variety. Some griffins don't have beaks. Most of them, and most of what we refer to as griffins, are actually just various mishmashes of different bird and mammal and other features. And I think the Cyclops as well is a really important one to bring up, because if it's allegedly based on elephant skulls, and it is true that skulls of pygmy elephants, if you haven't seen one, have this big central cavity that's a nasal cavity, but it could easily, when you look at it, be interpreted as one big eye cavity in the middle. But there's also something elephants have that depictions of Cyclops don't usually show. <tusks. laughs> And that might sound like nitpicking, but I think that is an important point, because like elephants' tusks are pretty distinctive, even pygmy elephants, pretty distinctive, so I don't see why those would just get left out.
Not that they wouldn't have encountered, obviously, the skeletons and remains of pygmy elephants, because of course the gap between Mediterranean pygmy elephants and Greeks going everywhere and colonizing the Mediterranean and other places is not actually that long in a geological time sense.
Yeah.
But the idea that the myth started there is a bit hard to sustain, I think.
Yeah, and Mark Witten goes on to ask an important question, which I think ties in quite well with themes we've brought up in quite a few of our episodes before. Because he says we'll never be able to conclusively answer the question, did such and such fossil inspire such and such myth? That's not something that there will ever be a point to trying to answer. We weren't there. We don't know. And so he says perhaps it's a more salient question to ask, do we need X fossil or phenomenon in general in order to explain why a certain myth existed? And the answer is generally, and for Mark, the answer is no, and I would say for me as well, because one-eyed giants are a mythological creature that's actually developed independently in cultures all over the world, on almost every continent. I was looking into this, and there are examples of these sorts of creatures in Celtic regions, in Japan, in Brazil, all over the world. And cyclopses aren't the only creature where we see sort of similar myths arising in different places. And I think there are much better explanations for why these creatures exist that don't rely on us explaining why one iteration of it necessarily must have been inspired by elephant skulls. The elephant skulls give an incomplete explanation. And we can, I think, get a much more satisfactory insight into why certain myths exist and why they're so common even in cultures with no contact between them by looking at, for example, the symbolism of having one eye. I mean, eyes are pretty widely in human cultures regarded as having an association with wisdom and insight. And so mythological figures with lots of eyes are often very smart. They often possess divine insight. And conversely, a creature with one eye, there is a pretty clear symbolism of this creature is not very smart. And similarly with size as well, large creatures are often portrayed as being very stupid. I think there's just something about being really small that people interpret as being quite devious, you know? And look at children.
Yeah, and I don't even think you need to assign that much meaning to say why are cyclopses a common theme across lots of independent cultures, because like the answer may be as simple as it's not that big a leap to be like, what if a guy looked a bit weird? What if a human being looked slightly different? Wouldn't that be odd? Yeah, I mean, if you look at the Cyclops myth, Cyclopses are quite stupid. Like, think about the poor Cyclops that Odysseus had a fight with. If he had simply stopped to say, no, guys, when I said that nobody stabbed me, I mean, there was a guy named Nobody who stabbed me. This never occurred to him to change his syntax. And he probably got bullied by all the other Cyclopses for the rest of his life.
So yeah, we have these like collections of traits that are associated with each other and often appear in conjunction with each other. And these are just a few examples, the griffins and the Cyclops. There's lots and lots of other examples that people have claimed give evidence of ancient or pre-modern people interacting with fossils. There are even like ancient Greek and later descriptions of people finding these incredible fantastical skeletons, like, you know, in the desert, sort of brushing away the desert sand to reveal these beautifully intact, you know, frightening skeletal creatures. And I think that one's also, even though it sounds quite tempting, that one's also quite difficult because, unfortunately, historians lie. Pre-modern historians especially, and this is something that we've covered on the podcast before. And really, even though we have descriptions of those, for example, from Herodotus, that are reported as if they were fact, it's actually much, much more reasonable for us to assume that they're not.
There is at least one account of ancient people encountering fossils, which I do think probably is genuine because of the circumstances and the very specific conditions that are described. So there is an account of from Phlegion of Tralles, who is a servant of the Roman Emperor Hadrian, and he tells a story of Carthaginian soldiers digging a trench where they encountered two gigantic skeletons, which they assumed to be the corpses of giants. Now, Carthage, or modern Tunisia, is actually rich in mastodon and mammoth fossils, so it's not improbable that they did genuinely encounter fossils they took to be giants. Two things to add to that, though. Number one, you may notice that the category of giant already exists in this story. So this is not the story of the origin of the term giant and the concept of giant humans. And the second thing is, and this is, I think, a really important point, and the reason why I find this to be probably a genuine story, is that the soldiers were digging a dike and they weren't looking for fossils. So they were digging quite deep and not deliberately, they stumbled across them, which is, you know, how a lot of fossils have been discovered over the years. Because the truth is that unless you are specifically looking for fossils as a trained paleontologist, it is very, very hard in most places to find fossils, let alone things that the untrained eye would identify as fossils.
Yeah, because whatever image you may have in your mind of fossils and fossilized skeletons appearing to us as these, like, as these arrangements that look exactly like if a creature were to drop dead and all of its flesh were just to melt away, but it's left, like, perfectly preserved and articulated as if it was just yesterday, and you can see the way that the limbs are arranged yeah. and how all the bones fit together. Get that out of your mind.
Yeah, I mean, when people think about what the work of paleontology involves, I think they think of the second scene of Jurassic Park, where Alan Grant is terrorizing that chubby child with the giant raptor claw, where you have, yeah, this splayed out body, this perfectly preserved skeleton that is just below the surface or even peeking out.
And those types of fossils do exist. I mean, you might have seen images of the world famous Archaeopteryx fossil, which is in a very good, complete state. And fossils can be incredibly detailed. We have fossilized imprints of things like skin and scales and hair and teeth.
But those are all vanishingly unlikely yeah. and rare.
I think the reason why some of these images are so famous is because they are so rare. And actually that is very, very different to how most fossils are found.
Mm-hmm. Because the thing you got to remember is that 99.999999999999% of organisms will never be fossilized. The conditions for fossilization are very, very specific, as are the conditions needed for them to be encountered by people who aren't looking for them deliberately, which means that the fossil record is very patchy and inconsistent across different places. So the precise processes for fossil formation do differ, but generally, and the paleontologists in the audience are twitching already, so just so you know, this is going to be wrong, but it will be right enough for a general audience, all right? That's the only guarantee we give you on this show. So generally, you need an organism's body to have been quickly buried by sediment that was previously suspended in a liquid, almost certainly water. What this means is that fossilization is generally more likely in marine environments. So you're much more likely to have fossils of marine animals and plants than terrestrial ones.
Yeah, and crucially, when a vertebrate animal dies, so for instance, a land mammal, its body has to decompose into a skeleton that has to be fossilized then. And if that dead body ends up in water, the skeleton could be fossilized, but you know what might also happen? The water could very possibly scatter that skeleton across a great distance. And so that means that probably not every bone will fossilize. And even if they do, what's left will not be even remotely recognizable to any bystander as a skeleton. Especially because these will be discovered after they have been covered by layers and layers and layers of rock. And even if you could uncover each bone, it would probably look like absolutely nothing in particular.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, most dinosaur species that we know exist, and most species that we only know from millions of years old fossil records, most of these species we know from, like, a couple bones, maybe, like one vertebra or a few finger bones or similar. And it's a testament to how brilliant paleontologists are that they're able to extrapolate based on related fossils and what we know of extinct life. But we're not just digging up full skeletons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's another dimension to this, of course, which is the sort of geological conditions for a fossil to be found in the first place. So for you to stumble across a fossil, for it to be exposed enough for the untrained eye to identify it, it probably needs to be an area of high erosion. So that's why places like deserts, mountains, and coasts are really good for fossils. If you've ever been to the Somerset coast, quite a few of the coasts actually on the west coast of Britain, you get fantastic fossils. I remember when I went to Somerset with my family, I was walking back with just my pockets full of fossils. There was like ammonites everywhere you looked. It was incredible. But of course, having grown up in a bunch of places that weren't good for fossils, it was blowing my mind. But what you should take away from that is not just that it's very unlikely that a fossil is going to get exposed by the elements, but also that if a fossil is exposed by the elements, it's probably in the wrong place. Or I should say, quote-unquote, wrong place. So a marine fossil, for example, that's not in the sea, because chances are we're not going to stumble across most of the marine fossils at the bottom of the ocean because it's not the year 3000 and we don't live at the bottom of the ocean.
Yes, exactly. And the types of fossils that we associate with dinosaurs are also extremely difficult to notice, even if you are in an area where they exist, even if they have been at least partially exposed. What you're looking at, what paleontologists are looking for, is basically like a weird shaped rock.
Mm-hmm.
Fossils aren't actual bones. They are bones or other remnants for the most part. There's different types of fossils, but when you think of like the classic fossil, you're thinking of probably a bone that has since been replaced by minerals. So mm-hmm. basically a rock. It's basically a rock cast of a bone. So what you're looking for is basically a weird looking rock. And even paleontologists need to take a lot of care to identify which weird looking rocks are fossils and which are just weird looking rocks. I mean, I'm from Montana, which is sort of dinosaur country. It's the town I grew up in, Bozeman, has one of the most significant sort of paleontology centers in the United States. And I remember going on field trips there and going with my school class to go into their repository. We got to see all of the big fancy professional paleontologists at work carving out, you know, and scraping away layers of rock from these fossils. And I remember them showing us all of these different methods that you have to use, that you might have to scrape gently with a scalpel and hear the sound it makes, or you might have to examine it very closely under a lens or a microscope. In the field, you'll often hear people say that you should lick it because fossilized bones are slightly porous, and that's definitely something people do. I remember on the same class trip, actually, one of the kids in my class sort of spinning around to a table, not been told to approach or look at or touch, and grabbing like one piece of mineral off of it from this like big sort of sheet that they had out that they were working on, and asking the teacher, is this a fossil or a rock? And all of these paleontologists just like converged on this kid and were like,
no,
put it back, put it back. But yeah, so the point is, get this like image out of your head of someone in, you know, ye old England or medieval Europe stumbling upon these perfectly preserved intact skeletons. Like, as far as we can tell, that didn't really happen.
No. It doesn't tend to happen to this day. And when it does, it is such an incredible miracle that it probably reshapes an entire subfield of paleontology forever. We've been playing down up to this point the probability of somebody both stumbling across and then correctly identifying a fossil. But the thing is that we do know that medieval people did find fossils and identify that they were something different from normal rocks. Now, I should say at this point, they did not use the word fossil. That's an early modern invention. And even then, in the early modern period, it initially just means thing that was dug up out of the ground. Because until the 18th century, it wasn't universally accepted that fossils were the remains of extinct creatures. So using the framework of fossil in this way, I accept, is anachronistic. But unfortunately, this is a general history podcast, so I'm going to have to use it, because otherwise people are going to get really confused.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why would medieval people have written so much about fossils? Well, I think part of the explanation is that fossils are very strange and challenging to a lot of the core assumptions of the medieval Abrahamic world and the medieval Abrahamic model of the universe and creation that we've kind of explored in previous episodes that was shared across Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And one of the fundamental assumptions of the Abrahamic faiths is that, at least until, you know, the Enlightenment, is that the history of humanity is synonymous with the history of the earth. The idea that there is a prehistory, something before recorded time, is incomprehensible, because what does the Hebrew Bible start with?
In the beginning.
Yeah. And then everything gets made over the course of that story. So the idea that there is something before human record is an alien concept. And that has other implications for how medieval people thought about things like extinction.
As we've discussed on the podcast before, medieval cosmology, so the perception of what is the universe and what does it look like and how is it arranged, they derived a lot of that from the classical world and from classical cosmology. And however, of course, they did also adapt it to suit their Abrahamic worldview. Because in the classical, as the medieval perception, the universe was created intelligently and with intention. So everything was given a place. There was a concept called the Great Chain of Being. I don't know if you read about this at all, Aaron.
I've heard of it.
But it's basically, at the very least, a running theme in cosmology all the way from the classical era until we sort of wrote God out of the picture, science-wise. And it's basically the idea of a ranking of all of the creatures
on tier list. Let's go. Yeah. Lions, goated.
Yeah, exactly. And you can imagine,
sheep, mid.
Oh yeah, you can imagine where things rank respectively, where snails rank in comparison to tigers, for instance. And this ties into the overarching classical and medieval view of the world as and the universe as being ordered. We've already talked about the idea of an ordered cosmos and
the great machine.
Exactly. And so this is really just another manifestation of that. And because everything was seen as having a purpose and an intent behind its creation and its nature, the idea of species going extinct did not figure into this worldview at all.
Yeah, I should say, by the way, the argument that extinct creatures are just animals that didn't get on Noah's Ark is not something you see in medieval sources, to my knowledge. I think that's a modern argument that you that crops up really in the sort of culture wars around evolution in the U.S.
Yeah, and it really just wasn't something that was discussed as a serious possibility, extinction. Really, not until around the end of, like, the 18th century. And even then, it was unbelievably controversial. So throughout the early modern period in the 17th century, there were discoveries of things like giant nautilus shells or the antlers of extinct giant Irish elk. And these things baffled people, but they generally wrote them off as just saying, well, these are creatures that maybe don't exist in the place where we found this anymore, but they probably exist somewhere. Those giant nautiluses probably just live at the bottom of the sea. Or maybe this was just one really big deer. For some
reason, this the deer king of the deer.
Gigantic. And so often, you know, the fact that there's natural variability within species was used to explain some of these things that people found.
But it's like dogs.
Exactly. But really the idea that an entire species could just disappear off the earth forever was not something that was treated as possible. That might sound a little bit ridiculous, but I think this is also because we have a very granular idea of what a species is nowadays. So a species might be a type of creature that only lives in, like, tide pools on one beach or something. But medieval people weren't dividing species to the same extent and thinking about species as these discrete things to the same extent.
Yeah, they weren't thinking about it. That's an African elephant. That's a... Or, like, we've talked before about the African forest elephant or the Maltese pygmy elephant. A medieval person would just go, mate, that's an elephant.
Exactly.
See, the elephants in this region are angrier than the elephants in this other region. We don't know why.
Yep.
Another thing to remember is that while it may seem a bit ridiculous to not have a concept of a sort of a type of animal of which there is obviously going to be a finite amount, how can you not conceive of that being sort of ground down and destroyed? You got to remember that A, this is a world that has not been fully mapped. The idea that there is, like, another place out there somewhere, not inconceivable. I mean, people have been thinking about Antipodean continents since time of classical Greece. So yeah, of course, who knows? There might be a big island full of lions. So even if all the even if we kill all the Barbary lions, there's going to be lions somewhere else, obviously. And also, like, there's no centralized tracker of how many lions are there. Nobody's counting them. To be able to know that a species is extinct, you need to have a level of understanding of the natural world that is pretty much total, and you need to have the economies of scale to actually track population levels, which, I'm sorry, is pretty much impossible to do reliably, let alone getting normal people to access that data. But you didn't come to us to talk about science and speciation and things like that. You came to us to hear about history. So let's talk about history, and let's talk about the explanations that people had for the fossils that they did encounter, because people did notice that some rocks looked like animals. So medieval science offers us a couple of potential explanations for what a fossil is that I think it's worth us going over in this episode. And the first explanation that I want to talk about is really more of a terminological one at its core, which is that the idea that fossils are figured stones. So this is an idea that dates to classical times. Basically, it's the idea that what appears to be the remains of an organism is in fact a lapidus figurati, which means that essentially a rock that, for either because of divine intelligence or pure luck, happens to look like an animal. It's essentially the rock version of, you look at your piece of toast and your toaster is made the Shroud of Turin. This category, I should say, includes both what we would now consider fossils, but also rocks that consider that contain just recognizable images through color variation. So, like, oxidization producing a rock that looks like it has a skull in it, to pick a completely random example. Now, how does this process happen? Well, the answer comes to us from Aristotle. Now, Aristotle says that basically the reason for figured stones is because of the celestial machine. Under certain unusual celestial conditions, the generative force, through the actions of the primus mobile and then directing the sort of the different celestial entities, which of course has, as we explored in a previous episode, has impacts on the material plane down on Earth. This generative force basically impresses an image on the rock, to quote Aristotle, upon a seed of an entirely different kind and in opposition to the formative power inherent to that seed. And we know that these kind of images, whether it was, again, the picture, like a picture of Jesus showing up on the side of a rock through oxidization, or a fossil, we know that this sort of troubled the medieval consciousness, and we have examples from literature, actually, of these figured stones showing up with a sort of moral meaning to them. So I'm going to read a quick quote from Love and Sensuality, which is a Middle English love allegory poem, and I do want to just say that what I'm about to read is not translated into modern English, and I'm going to butcher it, so don't yell at me. Stones in Israel found, some square and some round, imprinted of their own kind, for craft was there set behind. For I trow that no man switch steel's grave can, for nature who taketh kip, passeth soothly workmanship, for craft is subget unto kind, and man is wit can not find, but resemblance of no finger to be eagle unto nature. So basically what is being said here is that the fact that these rocks resemble sort of things that humans can recognize is a sign of nature and divine will, by extension, having a sort of artistic quality that is greater than anything that human beings can create. So basically, God's a better artist than you. Deal with it. Now, I do want to take a brief detour out of the Middle Ages, since we're talking about figured stones, because the idea of fossils being figured stones actually lasts much longer than the Middle Ages. And I found in researching this episode a story that is too good not to share. We're not going to get another episode to talk about it on the podcast, so I may as well do it now. Do you know, Olivia, the story of Beringer's lying stones?
I do not.
Okay, so this is very exciting. So, Johann Beringer was a professor of medicine at the University of Würzburg in the 18th century. This is a period when the nature of fossils was very much still up for scientific debate. And he was well known among his community as an arrogant twat who was very publicly committed to the idea that fossils were hidden in the earth deliberately by God, either as a test of faith or for his own entertainment. Now, because his fellow scholars found him intolerable, one of the university's librarians teamed up with a local baron, the Baron von Hoff, to prank him. So what they did was they carved chunks of limestone with images including fish, mermaids, the name of God in Latin, the name of God in Hebrew, and the name of God in Arabic, comets and stars. So what they did then was they hid the rocks in a spot where they knew that Beringer would come across them in one of his fossil hunts. And I want you, Olivia, to search for Beringer's lying stones and describe them to me, because it's very important context for what I'm about to...
Okay, okay.
And I want you to tell me whether or not you, Olivia M. Swarthout, would be convinced by these.
Those are really good. Wow. They definitely look molded by human hands. Maybe human hands belonging to a child, 5 or 6. They're very charming.
They're very sweet, aren't they?
They're really cute. They're all like these big blobby sort of like hybrid little like ocean rat.
So Beringer found these and he immediately lost his shit, because he's like, I'm right, I've always been right, look, it says God in Hebrew. So he decided that he had to write a book about this. So at this point even some of his friends and even somebody who knew what the scam was sort of came to him and said, hey man, I really do not think you want to go out on this limb. I don't think this is going to end well for you. And I'm just going to read from the article that I found this story in, because I think this articulates his response so much better than I ever could. In one contemptuous chapter, he dismisses all their evidence, denouncing it as a ruse of his rivals to deprive him of the honor of making known his discoveries and of publishing so important a contribution to science. He argues that, since the workers employed by him to unearth the fossils knew no tongue save their own, they manifestly could not have made inscriptions in Hebrew, Arabic, Babylonian, and Syrian. Needless to say, he had first convinced himself that no one save he and the workers, as he says, some bo- hang on, where's his voice? He's German. Some to find. I've got. Yeah, there he is. Some boys of a tender age had ever set foot upon the mountain whence he had come across the marvelous insectiform stones. So he goes and he writes his book about how this proves all of his theories that God is leaving fossils, because he even signed them.
Of course. It's like a child signing his, macaroni art.
I was going to say like Banksy.
Oh, yeah.
And he publishes the book, and he's basically immediately left out of the scientific community. He ends up suing some of the people who scammed him and winning, but he still completely destroyed his reputation as a scientist, and he just died shortly after of a broken heart.
Aww.
But there's one more twist, because that's not the end of the story. After he died, an unscrupulous bookseller in Hamburg found his book, found it absolutely hysterical, and printed another edition.
Oh, that's rough.
So that people could laugh at him more.
I like it when you can tell from a historical record of someone getting clowned on. They were just a complete gullible, just sort of moron. I mean, that's even... Even in the 1700s, that is a ridiculous thing to fall for.
There are two things. There's nothing that I love more than somebody who's incredibly arrogant having a fall from grace. And if you add to that the fact that, again, what I love about this story is everybody in his life being like, hey, man, please don't. which tells you exactly what kind of guy he was. And they're so bad.
There's no doubt that the people who set him up did not expect it to go this far. When they saw that book hit ye old German bookshelves in ye old German bookstores, I cannot stress enough. They were probably absolutely freaking out. Like, oh no,
we're going to prison.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of it. Like, there's definitely modern analogs to this, right?
I don't know. I mean, everyone is falling for misinformation these days. I think that's the problem.
I mean, that's the great thing about those figured stones is they do look slightly AI generated.
Yeah.
Like, the proportions are off.
Yeah.
Again, like, it looks like, please Google this, because, like, the fish ones, they look like if you asked a child to draw fish skeleton.
It definitely is reminding me of those fake medieval medallions. What are they called? The, like, Billy and Charlie or something medallions. You know, the Victorian forgeries that were made by these two illiterate guys, and so all of the letters are just squiggles. Have we talked about those?
Yeah, not on the show, but we have talked about it.
Those are good. Get you to the Docklands Museum.
I'm working on it. So that was not medieval, but that was just a fun aside. So figured stones, I think we can agree, not really consistent with the modern understanding of what a fossil is. A thing that happens to look like another thing because of gibbous. But that wasn't the only theory going around there. There was an alternate model, an alternate explanation, which I'm just going to call petrification, which comes to us from a scholar by the name of Ibn Sina, or as he was known as in the West,
Avicenna.
Yes. So Avicenna was an 11th century Persian physician and sort of general polymath who wrote an influential text on geology in his book, The Book of Healing. Now, he was widely read and I should say he was hugely influential in the Muslim world, but he was also widely influential in translation in the Christian world as well.
Yes, so Avicenna was especially significant because he was a scholar of Aristotle. So he read a lot of Aristotle. He commented extensively on Aristotle, translated Aristotle, I believe, into both Arabic and Latin, and he also wrote his own expansions on Aristotle's ideas and theories, and many of these were transmitted via Latin editions into into medieval Europe and into medieval Christian scholarship as well. So much, in fact, that in some cases, Avicenna's writings were mistakenly attributed to Aristotle. So, in fact, he wrote a work called De Mineralibus, on minerals, that was often appended to the end of Aristotle's meteorological writings, often with no attribution, so was often assumed to have been written by Aristotle as well.
Yeah, so despite being a student of Aristotle, Avicenna actually got quite a lot closer in his explanation for what fossils are than Aristotle did. So I'm going to read very briefly from one of his works, where he presents a model of the history of Earth that is, I would say, radically closer to our own understanding than we are used to thinking about medieval people and their sort of scientific understanding. So he says, the formation of stones in abundance is either at once due to an intense heat over a vast mud area, or little by little through a sequence of days, most probably from accumulative clay, which has slowly dried and petrified during ages of which we have no record. It seems likely that this habitable world was in former days uninhabitable. Indeed, submerged beneath the sea. Then becoming exposed little by little, it petrified in the course of ages, the limits of which history has not preserved. Now, isn't that fascinating? Because here already we have a lot of ideas that we've already said aren't sort of consistent with the standard Abrahamic model of the universe, the idea that there are ages which history has not preserved. I mean, obviously there's lots of cracks and gaps in the biblical sort of history of the universe, and dating of the earth, of the age of the earth was never a precise science until in the pre-modern era. But still, the idea that you can have a place that's land that was ocean before, and also that there are these vast tracts of history of which we know very, very, very little, is a fascinating idea, isn't it? Because it's basically what we think now.
Yeah, and I was reading some of his writings on geology and how mountains are formed, because he also has some ideas about that, And he more or less correctly supposes that the way that our landscapes are shaped is primarily by earthquakes and erosion. So, of course, earthquakes, strictly speaking, it's not just that in reality, or it might be more correctly referred to by geologists as tectonic forces, but those cause earthquakes. So, here's a quote from him as well. He says, the formation of... Sorry, I'm not going to do a voice. The formation of heights is brought about by A, an essential cause, and B, an accidental cause. The essential cause is when, as in many violent earthquakes, the wind which produces the earthquake raises a part of the ground and a height is suddenly formed. In the case of the accidental cause, certain parts of the ground become hollowed out while others do not by the erosive action of the winds and floods which carry away one part of the earth but not another. Yes, that part which suffers the action of the current becomes hollowed out, while that upon which the current does not flow is left as a height.
Yeah, so he has a pretty... I mean, it's not perfect, but a basic understanding of the material forces of geology. And he expands on this by talking about, or commenting on what we now think of as fossils. So he says, now, the cause of this phenomenon is a powerful mineralizing and petrifying virtue which arises in certain stony spots or emanates suddenly from the earth during earthquakes and subsistence and petrifies whatever comes into contact with it. As a matter of fact, the petrification of the bodies of plants and animals is not more extraordinary than the transformation of waters. So basically, he correctly identifies that it's the water in the rock that causes petrification, but he doesn't really have a model for how that happens.
Well, I'm actually going to push back on that a little bit, because he does... He does and he doesn't. I would say more that he does.
Well, it's not what we would consider to be a traditional scientific process.
Perhaps not. But essentially, what he claims, or what he is claiming in this passage, is that there is a kind of stonifying essence contained within the earth, and in particular in certain places or within certain substances. And he says that this essence can cause water to turn into stone. And so in some of his writings, he points to the existence of stalactites and stalagmites, where it's easy to observe the fact that they are obviously formed by dripping water. And he says that there must be some kind of substance causing the water to turn into stone. So what he is saying is that water is turning into stone. And this is because of some contact with stone, mm-hmm. essentially, with the essence within stone. And so his perspective differs in that regard, because we now know that fossilization is caused by stone particles being deposited by the water.
Mm-hmm.
But what he's saying is that in the same way that dripping along a stalactite or a stalagmite might cause water to turn into stone, so too could similar contact with stone turn the remains of a plant or an animal into stone. And so he likens the way that this might happen and this stonifying essence, so to speak, to that of fire. So he says that fire tends to turn that which it touches into fire, and so this process follows basically the same principle. And so we've been using words like essence and essential with regards to these ideas, and I think it's important to mention that I'm not just throwing these ideas, this word essential around in a colloquial way. The concept of an essence and of essentialism is one that's existed since classical times, and one that Avicenna very much brought forward into the medieval world and medieval scholarship based on his study of Aristotle and of classical philosophy and cosmology. And so you might have heard the word essentialism used in phrases like, for instance, gender essentialism, so the idea that men and women are innately different based purely on their gender. Or I think another good example of how this type of thing is discussed today is the concept of human nature. So an essentialist point of view would posit that there is an unchangeable sort of universal human nature that we all share. And that would be in contrast to ideas like materialism and constructivism, which would say that it's more based on environmental things. So it's kind of a nature versus nurture thing. But in the classical and medieval world, in Aristotle and Avicenna's world, this isn't just about like human behavior and human society. This is also something that can be discussed as applies to things like stones and fire and water. And so in this worldview, and this is still, I think, at the heart of discussions of essentialism today, a substance has an essence, and the essence is defined as the thing without which that substance could not exist. So if that sounds confusing and or somewhat circular as a definition to you, then I don't blame you. I also find it a little bit confusing. To make matters more confusing, an example that's often given by modern philosophers is to say that H2O is the essence of water. Without H2O, water could not exist. And so you can see this idea of an essence is a very slippery one, but it was one that medieval and classical scholars pursued pretty relentlessly because it fits so well into this idea of a divinely and intelligently created universe, and importantly, an ordered universe. So for things to have a place in the universe, they must have some kind of unchangeable essence that makes them that way. And if that essence is taken away, then they no longer are that thing. And so there were questions that were thrown about by philosophers asking things like, well, what is the essence? Is it a physical thing? Is it something you can observe? Does everything have an essence? You know, does mud have a different essence to dirt? And if these things have essences, then how can we change, for instance, mud into dirt by adding water? And so the idea of essences is things that could act upon other things and change those things was an important part of that. You know, we add water to dirt, it becomes mud because the dirt is being acted upon by the watery essence of the water. And so again, it's very circular and slightly, feels slightly sort of...
It's very self-evident as to why we don't use that terminology and that framing today. It hinders as much as it helps.
Yeah, definitely. But I think this is the logical framework of a society and culture that doesn't have a sort of modern scientific understanding. Now we can look at your cells under a microscope, and we can look at your DNA, and we can look at how your traits and your features and everything that you are and everything that anything is. We can look at stones and trees and, you know, whatever else, other things too, no doubt.
She's run out of objects that she can think of.
Yeah. Let me look around the room.
Microphone.
Can of beer.
Box. television. Ma'am.
But in absence of a way of understanding how things were created and what made them the way that they are, this was the framework for understanding that. And a lot of science today works like that as well. I mean, it's a little bit like dark matter.
Mm.
Something must be making this way, so let's give it a name while we work on trying to figure out what it is. And that is essentially what the essence is. And that is what Avicenna writes about.
So to bring this full circle, what he's saying is there is some sort of petrifying essence within a substance that is released under certain conditions that turns things... So it turns living material into stone.
Yes, exactly. And so that's what he's saying fossils are, essentially. And he is able to give some interesting insights, and again, some surprisingly accurate and relevant ones, because he looks at limestone with fossils of sea creatures in it, and he says, although these stones form cliffs and mountains now, because we can see these petrified sea creatures in them, that must mean that they were once under the ocean. And so he has this idea that this is how stones and landscapes and mountains are formed, by the petrification of water. That's one way.
The man who scorns to yield.
I will say there is an elephant in the room that we have to discuss when we're talking about medieval explanations for why is fossil in wrong place, which is that there is another model that's not Avicenna's. Can you guess what it is? The flood.
Oh, yeah, right.
The big flood.
Yes.
Yeah, so the biblical flood of Noah and the Ark story was a common alternate explanation for why maritime fossils were showing up on the sides of mountains and in other places they really shouldn't be if the Earth was a stable entity. Because the reason for that is because simply in the biblical story, after Genesis, the flood is kind of the only big thing that happens vis-a-vis water. And so we have a great quote from Ristoro d'Arezzo, who was a monk who was one of the first authors to write a scientific text in vernacular Italian, interestingly, who talks about how we have picked up and excavated near the top of a very high mountain quantities of shells and of... No, that's Spanish. I've become Spanish. That's bad.
Mamma mia.
Mamma mia. Oh, yes. We have picked up and excavated near the top of a very high mountain quantities of shells of those fishes which we call cockles or mussels, similar to those which painters use to hold their colors. And in that place they are found mixed with sand and with round stones among them, both large and small, as if they came from rivers. And this is a sign that the mountain was made by the deluge, which means, of course, the flood. What I hope you're getting from this section is the fact there are a lot of different scientific theories of varying levels of veracity that are bouncing around in medieval science and medieval geology in this period, and that it's actually quite problematic to talk about what did medieval people think fossils were.
Yes.
Because they did not agree.
Yeah, but the idea of some connection between waters and these fossils was a pretty far-reaching one. This was something that actually did also originate in ancient Greece, so I should say this is not... don't fiddle with that, by the way, while we...
Okay.
So this is something I should say was originated in ancient Greece, not by Avicenna himself. And it extended to different kinds of stones as well. So to expand on that a little bit, we have a strong association in the Middle Ages between and earlier... between marble and the ocean. So I don't know if you, Aaron, know the Latin word for sea or ocean.
Mare.
Mare. And that is the same root as marble, the stone.
Because it looks like the sea.
It does look like the sea a lot. And
wait, I can sense where this is going. This is so awesome.
And so the rippling, almost wave-like patterns that are seen in marble were often used in cathedral floors and often used to generate a sort of water-like effect on a floor. And often skilled masons would actually line up the seams of marble, different panels of marble, to try to create continuous wave-like patterns. This actually existed on the floor of the Hagia Sophia for several centuries. I believe it has since been covered up and potentially is in the process now of being re-excavated. And the fact that there were often these marine fossils found in stones also strengthened the association between different types of stones and the sea, and the idea that types of stones might have come about through the petrification of waters. And so, for instance, in different locations where marble was quarried, it was believed that the marble came about because mountains contained within them a sort of marbly liquid brew. And that when these mountains were quarried, they could actually sweat out this brew and it would re-petrify. And the scars from the quarries would heal themselves and more stones would form.
It's like a Cadbury's cream egg.
A little bit, yeah.
No, don't dignify with a little bit.
One example of this that was known in the Middle Ages, or was considered to be an example of this, was the location in present-day Turkey of Hierapolis. And this is a place where you have these incredible natural hot springs, and they almost form a terrace shape as they cascade down the side of this marble mountain. And that's because of the calcification of that's because of these layers of calcification that build up, so it's water depositing limestone particles that form these limestone walls that contain pools within them. And so it would have been so easy to look at that, look at such a phenomenon. I mean, look at that.
Looks awesome.
Looks awesome. And to think, you know, and to understand that on some level, this was because of the action of the waters. This was because of something within mm-hmm. the water, whether it's the essence or, as we know now, just small bits of rock.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a way that you can interpret the kind of essences as a theoretical framework as being an attempt to understand a just all kind of microscopic processes, but also the idea of solvents.
Yeah.
The idea that something can be dissolved in water, which of course, you know, if you're doing any kind of like experimentation, it's one of the first things you do.
Yeah.
Putting things in water and making them hot are the two kinds of experiments you do in high school science.
Yeah. And so I think this association between stones and fossils and marble and the sea was really ideologically potent in the Middle Ages as well. And I think the sea in particular, I mean, it features really heavily in Christianity, doesn't it? The sea and water. I mean, what's Jesus' symbol?
Fish.
It's a fish. And you have all sorts of different allegories and different associations with water. Often they're very negative. So you have the Great Flood, in which water is very destructive. And Jonah and the whale, which is also arguably a bad association with water. Although we often talk about a heaven and earth dichotomy, water in the medieval mind was almost sort of more material and more changeable than earth. And this comes back to what we discussed previously in our episode about medieval space, the dichotomy of things that are fixed versus things that change, and the pure and holy nature of that which does not change versus the corrupt earthly nature of things that are subject to change, the fickleness. And so the heavens in the medieval mind are perfect because they do not change. The superlunary sphere, everything above the moon, doesn't change. It's perfect. It's fixed. It is essential. And that which is below the moon, i.e. earth, that's the imperfect stuff. That's the bad stuff. That's the stuff that does change. And the ocean and water in general are a very good encapsulation of change and of the destructive power of change. And so I was reading this interesting paper that said that this was one association that might have led to these marble stones being used so frequently in floors of cathedrals and churches like the Hagia Sophia, because the water is a reminder of the danger of this mutable earthly nature. And it's a reminder that even though above you, when you look up in a church, you see symbols of heaven, you might see the zodiac or stars or symbols of the cosmos, and it might make you feel very divine, but you should always remember to look down and remember what's at your feet and what might swallow you up. So you see this in bestiaries as well. The whale is often a symbol of the devil, the idea being that sin might drag you down to the pits of hell, just like a whale might drag you down to the bottom of the ocean, which we now know whales don't do. But in the bestiary.
Unless you really piss them off.
Yeah.
I do want to say, though, I think that there's a real ambivalence to the role that water has in a pre-modern context. Because another thing to remember about water is that in a world in which actually overland travels quite hard, there are no asphalt roads, there are no railroads, water is actually equally likely to be a medium for human connection. It's the, like, trade happens through rivers and along coasts, and as such, water is fated with all of these different meanings that contains within it so much. Classic example of that being the Mediterranean, which now today in our worlds is has a separating essence, to yes. to borrow from Avicenna. It is the thing that separates Europe from Africa. But in the classical and medieval world, the Mediterranean was this thing that facilitated connections between all these different cultures and peoples from the Levant to the Straits of Gibraltar. So water is, it's a destructive transformational force, but it also is vibrant, and it is basically, in essence, as you say, it is the essence of change and transformation on so many different levels.
Fossil stones. So they're called, I think, what, fossiferous stones. So stones that have fossils in them, often limestone, were used very prominently in church architecture, and especially in floors, sometimes in columns as well. Even now, you will often see buildings with fossil-bearing stones in the floors. And I think that this aquatic imagery on floors that proliferated in the Middle Ages and that you still get now, I think that also has an element of duality, because on one hand, it is a reminder of the dangers of the changing and the mutable, but on the other hand, especially in the context of a church, I think it would have been a really powerful reminder of the position of God as the divine orderer of things, and as the person who, or as the entity that gives everything its place in the divine order, that even these changing, shifting things can be made into something eternal and long-lasting and immutable.
Okay, so I think we've outlined in the last section a lot of the reasons why, if you're a medieval person, you would be primed to think of fossils as being significant. Because of their various associations with God and the cosmos and human existence, etc., etc., etc. So I think it's worth closing out this episode by talking about a few of the myths associated with specific fossils and specific kinds of fossils. So I have three that I'd like us to go through. So the first of these I want to talk about are ammonites, or as they were known in medieval times, snake stones.
Yes.
So this is one of the major things to note about medieval sort of fossil naming conventions is, you know, because they're likely to be thought of and categorized as rocks that look like real things as opposed to dead animals, they tended to be called, you know, thing rock or thing stone. So ammonites were called snake stones. So it's ammonites, if you Google them now, they look a bit like coiled and decapitated snakes. And this has never been lost on people. So, for example, William Camden in 1586 said of ammonites that, "If you break them, you find within stony serpents wreathed up in circles, but eternally without heads." And he was being very serious there. That wasn't a metaphor. Break an ammonite, there's a snake in there, mate.
Wow.
Yeah. So we have one medieval associated myth about ammonites relating to St. Hilda, a 7th century English abbess and a key figure in the spread of Christianity among Anglo-Saxon England. Now, I should say that this myth, how old is it? It's hard to tell, but it is associated with a medieval character, so I think it's worth including here. So St. Hilda wanted to found an abbey at Whitby, but there was one problem. Can you guess what it was?
It was underwater.
Wrong. It was full of snakes.
No!
And so basically, because snakes are, you know, the origin of all sin, Hilda basically said, well, that won't do. So you have to remove them before you can found something holy. So he prays to God. So he prayed to God, and God was like, don't worry, babe, I've got you. So the snakes all spontaneously coiled up. So she went round and cut their heads off with a sword.
Whoa.
I know. What a baddie. At which point, when she cut each of their heads off, they turned to stone. Hmm. And you know what you have a lot of at Whitby?
Fossil ammonites.
Yes.
Woohoo. I finally got it.
The second one of these that I want to talk about is tongue stones. Tell me what tongue stones are.
It's pronounced tungsten. Periodic table?
No. Fossilized shark's teeth.
Yes.
So, fossilized shark's teeth, because of a belief in what's called sympathetic magic, which is basically, we've talked about it before on the show, but you should, to treat a part of the human body, you should use something that looks like that part of the human body. So, of course, shark's teeth were used to test for poison, because a tongue looks like a shark's tooth, kind of, a little bit, not really.
You squint.
Yes. Now, Olivia, do you know where to find the best tongue stones?
Inside this weird spiral shell I just dug out at Whitby.
Wrong. So, Malta has an absolutely gigantic supply of fossilized shark's teeth due to the fact that it's essentially one gigantic piece of limestone that's just been thrust out of the ocean. Malta, by the way, quick sidebar about Malta. I love Malta. I've been many times. It's one of the strangest places to become like a big holiday destination because it essentially doesn't have beaches. They don't do beaches. The land just stops. Because again, it is one giant piece of limestone. The land doesn't become beach. It just goes away.
It's not sandstone.
So Malta, anyway, point being, Malta has a gigantic supply of fossilized shark teeth. They are everywhere. And they were believed to be the finest tongue stones going. It was essentially the equivalent of like the EU's like place of origin rules now. It's like, this is real. These are real Maltese stones. And the reason for that, the reason that was thought for why Malta is full of tongue stones is because of actually a story from the Bible. Because Malta, I don't know if you know this, is one of the only places named in the Bible. Or countries outside of the Levant named in the Bible. Because St. Paul gets shipwrecked there in AD 80. And when that happened, St. Paul blessed the land that gave him life, which banished poison. And in doing so, made all the reptiles in Malta completely harmless. And this is a story, by the way, that still, according to my Maltese friend, is still repeated verbatim in Malta to this day. It's like, everybody in Malta knows this. Now, one last bit about Malta before we move on. So the Cathedral Museum in Medina, Malta, has a fantastic preserved display rack. So they made these brilliant display racks for you to show off all of your tongue stones that essentially they took a big bit of red coral, encased bits of it in gold, and just hung little shark's teeth from it from gold chains. It looks cool as fuck. I'm only mentioning this because of my own personal experience at the Medina Cathedral Museum in Malta, which, if you've never been, is a fantastic museum. It has one of the best, like, collections I've seen in Europe of, like, ecclesiastical artifacts and the beautiful, beautiful art. There's only one problem. None of it is labeled. So it's basically, it's like a deconstructed museum. It's like an experiment. Like, it was a fun challenge for me walking around being like, I'm going to say 12th century, maybe. It was like being at work, but it was very fun, which is probably the reason why I don't remember seeing this thing here. Because I was just like, that's a weird looking tree. So that's Maltese tongue stones. All the Maltese people who've been telling me to talk about Malta on the podcast, you can stop telling me now. There's one last kind of stone that I need to talk about today, which is...
I have no idea.
Jew stones.
Nice.
So, Jew stones was the name given to the fossilized spines of extinct sea urchins. The reason why they were called that is because they were thought to, and I use the quote, I use this term here liberally, they were thought to grow, quote-unquote, in Judea. And they had medicinal properties if dissolved in water. To quote the Roman physician Dioscorides, "But ye Judaical stone grows in Judea, in fashion like a glands. Why, of very handsome form, having also lines answering one another, as if made by turning. Being dissolved, it yields no relish in ye taste. But if a size a lot bigness, therefore, being dissolved like a collierite in a whetstone with 3 cianti of warm water and drank, is a force to break ye stones in ye bladder." So basically, it looks like gallstones. So you use it to treat gallstones. And again, this is another example of sympathetic magic at work. Now, the most detailed summary of what you use them for comes from the 17th century physician Wirtzung, who recommends a series of treatments for gallstones. So first of all, you need to inject clysters, which is a type of medicine, into your rectum, or insert suppositories of licorice, melon seed, pompion seed, gourd seed, cucumber seed, fennel, and or hollyhock. And if those fail, you crush up some Jew stones and mix them into various confections or bath bombs or syrups. Now, dew stones are also very useful when you're letting blood. So you should powder them and feed them to your patient, mixed with herbs and other various medicines like, you know, the classic medicines we all know, like dried pike bones, calcined hairs, buck's blood, the ashes of wagtails, burnt glass, and the leftover eggshells from the hatching of chicks. So I'll give you one recipe for a poultice you should feed one of your patients before you let their blood. Item: take oil of scorpions, 3 ounces, burnt sponge stones, and burnt wagtails of each 3 drachmas. Jew stone, 1 drachma. Make a salve or a plaster thereof with wear. So it's basically like, okay, I know it sounds bad that I'm going to cut you open and drain you of your blood, but don't worry, before I give that to you, I'm going to feed you a concoction of scorpion oil that also includes a kind of rock that tastes bad. See, medieval, again, we've spent all this time building up, like, oh, you know, medieval science. It's like there's so many different ideas bouncing around, and some of them are, you know, they're grasping at something real, and then it's like, but also scorpion oil.
Up your bum. As far as macroscopic larger fossils go, there was one account I could find of I think it was a woolly rhinoceros skull being dug up in a quarry in Germany in the 14th century. And this was actually used as the basis, allegedly, for a depiction of a dragon that was put in a fountain in the town of Klagenfurt in Germany a couple centuries later. I couldn't actually find many records from when this skull was allegedly dug up in, I believe, 1335. And I found that really interesting. I think in general, I think it is quite interesting. We have maybe a little bit elided, like, one of the questions people might still have at this point, which is like, but, like, did medieval people ever just dig up a really big bone, and what did they think about it? And it is something that we just don't really have records of.
Yeah.
And I think the sources are just so mixed, and we do have so many examples of, for instance, you know, Plato saying, and then they dug up a complete giant skeleton here, and he still had all his clothes on, and everything, and his giant wife skeleton was nearby, and there's
my wife,
dog, too.
My dog.
And then he woke up and started talking like Borat. I think separating myth and from fact and actually kind of finding reliable information about this type of thing in the Middle Ages is really, really difficult. And people who didn't have the context that they needed in order to actually identify what these things were, and who weren't able to push forwards a new idea for what these bones and these fossils and these remnants might represent. And they're very far from being able to do that, because only in the 1800s that it becomes something like slightly less laughable to say, oh, these might be the remnants of extinct creatures. And so I think without any kind of narrative that can be synthesized by people who are discovering these things, because yeah, there probably were medieval people quarrying and finding giant bones and finding like weird things occasionally, but there was just no real narrative that they could contribute these to apart from like, that's weird. And they weren't happening often enough.
Yeah.
Or common enough, like the shark, like, you know, unlike the shark teeth and the fossils in limestones, there was just no ability to create like a proper narrative of any sort, real or false.
Yeah, I think the thing that's, and I think that speaks first of all to the nature of communication in medieval time. Like, if Herbert of Herringbone found a big rock that looked like a leg, what would happen to it? Well, it might go on display at the church, man. Like, there's not really. Yeah. What do you want them to do with it? Like, yeah, it's an interesting curiosity. But there isn't, like you say, there's not the intellectual framework within which ordinary people would be equipped to understand these as part of a pattern. And to be honest, I imagine that Because remember, we've been talking about a lot of intellectual stuff, a lot of like university-educated people having serious arguments about, you know, what are these kinds of rocks. Most people would just look at a fossil and say, that's a weird-looking rock, and continue with their day.
Yeah.
And you can't prove that, because that's like something that would never be recorded.
Yeah.
You can't prove a negative, but that's my suspicion.
Yeah, and I think it's also like important to note that the discovery of dinosaurs and dinosaur fossils, which again really only started taking place in a serious way in the 1800s, that followed like centuries, not centuries, that followed decades of debate about whether it was even possible for an animal to go extinct. And it was really only then that we were able to take these bones and actually start recording them and categorizing them and studying them in a systematic way. And so in the Middle Ages, people were so far from being able to do that. And it's just like, this is one where I really don't think you can blame them, because you find a giant bone, okay, which of these two options sounds more appealing? This came from a guy who was like you, but a bit bigger? Or this is, you know, the results of a giant lizard creature unlike anything you could even conceive of that walked the earth 100 million years ago and died in a swamp, and then its bones were slow, the soft tissue and organic matter in its bones was gradually replaced, you know, through a process called like mineralization or whatever to create a calcified version of its bone, which has just sat here ever since. Like, I mean, the latter obviously is the truth, but it doesn't sound like it, does it?
No, you don't have either the, you don't have the technological expertise also to really effectively excavate fossils either.
Yeah.
So you don't know how much, if a fossil isn't fully, if a fossil skeleton isn't fully exposed, you're not even going to be able to necessarily find the rest of it.
Yeah.
Like, fossils are so interesting from a medievalist's point of view because they're one of the rare occasions where something intrudes on the medieval world, which was a world that, you know, bluntly had a pretty clearly self-sustaining and relatively complete understanding of itself and how the universe worked. Fossils aren't that. Fossils are wrong. Fossils are, in a very real sense, uncanny. And that's why I think people do, on some level, find that they know that this is important, because there's nothing in their worldview that that really explains this in a satisfactory way. It is an intrusion from a different universe of thought, basically. But at the same time, whilst you can tell that it's important, you also don't have any of the tools to understand it.
Yeah, and I think we're still in this process of trying to understand what our universe and our world is made of and what the laws are that govern it. And so I think it's important as well to retain that humility, because we are not so different to them. I mean, what is dark matter? What is string theory? We have so many words and concepts in science that are basically just band-aids to cover up the gaping holes in our understanding. Like, how do fish know where to go to have sex? How do bears know to go there when the fish are going there? How do they know when to hibernate? This nature is full of mysteries, and I think
They're on Fish Tinder, also known as Swimder.
Oh, I was gonna say Finder. Surely that's better.
It's much better. We're keeping them both in, though.
Surely the opposite of Tinder is like wet. Like
wetter.
Exactly.
Finder. <Okay. laughs> Well, that's about gonna do us for this episode of the Weird Medieval Guys podcast. I hope you enjoyed our foray into the world of dinosaur bones and fish sex and dew stones and all the other fun kind of stones that there are. And if you enjoyed this episode, please do give us a five-star review on your podcast platform of choice. It helps apparently with the algorithm in ways that I don't fully understand. It helps new people to discover the show. And if you really like it, you can also leave a comment on Spotify to tell us what you thought of the episode. And if you're lucky, one of us might read the comment out on the show.
Thank you to Diana, who said, Your podcast made me become the unbearable, obsessive geek of my friend and family group. Now everybody finds me annoying for saying, did you know that medieval people blah blah blah? Gracias por existir. Love from Mexico, where, quote, medieval guys were pretty weird too. I think it speaks to the hold that we have over our listenership, that we are ruining these people's lives, causing them to be ostracized by their friends and family thanking us for it. Just kidding. Thank you for the sweet comment, Diana. Yeah. And we would absolutely love to do an episode about weird pre-Columbian guys
at some point. Yes, so. I think there's many episodes in there. I think it's just a question of getting that ball rolling, really. Yeah. But so it's definitely something we've talked about quite a lot.
But yes, since the beginning, really.
Yeah, because Eurocentrism is boring. Oh, and also one last thing. If you want to talk to other people who like this show about things like history and art and culture and so on, then the Weird Medieval Guys Discord is popping off.
Yes, I'll put a link in the description to this episode.
And this link will work.
They've worked for like the past five episodes.
Yeah, but we still get comments about it.
I'm going to restart that. Thank you. Yes, I'll put a link in the description of this episode for you to join. We hope to see you there.
All right. I'll see you there. Until next time, take it easy.